Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A year ago today, to the cheers of jubilant onlookers, U.S. Marines surrounded by Iraqi citizens pulled down a massive statue of Saddam Hussein in the center of Baghdad. It had taken less than a month of high-tech, high-speed invasion to topple Saddam's regime. The famous sign said, "Mission accomplished." Iraq was declared free. Tonight, significant swaths of the country are in chaos. This week alone, more than 50 coalition troops and hundreds of Iraqis have died in fierce fighting as violence erupted from Sunni-controlled Fallujah to Baghdad to the Shiite south. U.S. troops are locked in urban guerrilla warfare. Well-armed opposition has moved from insurgency to uprising. Angry Sunni and Shia are at least flirting with making common cause against U.S. troops. Tonight on Point, Iraq 1 year on and a must-win American mission in trouble. Today, the U.S. military continued to battle opposition in central and southern Iraqi cities as Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's army fought U.S. troops in Kut and Nasiriyah, and an American offensive in the Sunni stronghold of Fallujah met determined resistance. Alyssa Rubin is covering the war in Iraq for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her if circumstances on the ground after a week of turmoil looked better or worse.
Well, I would say they're certainly not better. They're somewhat different than, it changes basically every day. But there's fighting in a number of different places. There's the U.S. military does seem to have gone on the offensive in several spots. There's an effort to negotiate some kind of a ceasefire in Fallujah, but that has not been completed yet, and it's not clear when or even if it will be. There were reports of large numbers, one of our staff, in fact, was in Fallujah and saw it, large numbers of Fallujah natives leaving the city, but then there were subsequent reports that they were turned back and had to return to the city, which many of them were very frightened to do because of the level of U.S. bombing and attacks. Most of those attacks are in response to insurgent fire. But at the same time, because the insurgents are often sheltering themselves in either civilian neighborhoods or actually civilian homes, they also are killing or injuring civilians, women, children.
Alyssa, what is known about how much of Fallujah is now in the hands of U.S. Marines? How much is in the Sunni insurgents' hands?
I don't have a clear sense of that, but my impression from today, they did attempt a ceasefire, and when that was sort of declared or when it was agreed upon, the insurgents continued to fire periodically, according to the U.S. military at least, at the U.S. military, and then the U.S. military returned fire, overwhelming fire apparently, and then the insurgents continued to fire. So it seems as if the U.S. still does not have control of the city, or at least not enough that anyone can negotiate a ceasefire that sticks.
And we heard earlier that women, children, and old people were being allowed to leave Fallujah. Now you're saying perhaps they've been turned back?
Yes, that is what I've heard. Again, it's very hard to verify it. The very difficult thing about covering the situation there is that it is not only is it too dangerous to go into Fallujah for a Westerner for obvious reasons, but the road there is terribly dangerous. There were reportedly, I believe, 4 or 5 people abducted on that road, Westerners, and there were also several soldiers killed on the road and vehicles destroyed. It runs through a town called Abu Ghraib, which is a very hardline Sunni town, very quite poor. It's the site of an enormous prison and has only sort of low-paid government jobs and not much else. I was there yesterday, and it really had already been taken over largely by men with guns. I couldn't tell who they were, but they were blocking the road. They were looking in cars. They were certainly a menacing force. They had set up fake roadblocks, and young men were shouting Allahu Akbar and sort of waving their AK-47s. So it's hard to go through there and get to even anywhere close to Fallujah where you could get a good sense of what's going on.
What about the Shiite uprising in Baghdad and to the south? Where does that stand today?
Well, I was down in Karbala today, and it was really quite quiet. I mean, it was, you know, as you know, there's a large religious festival, and in some ways one of the one or two largest of the Shiite year coming up over the weekend. And so there are just thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims streaming towards Karbala. And there were very organized checkpoints. They were manned by a variety of different militias, but they seemed to be working, you know, without any friction. But then shortly after I left, I heard a report from someone still there that there had been going to be fighting between two of the militias. And there has been regular fighting between the Mehdi army, which is loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, a quite anti-American fundamentalist Shiite cleric, and the coalition forces down there who are the Poles control Karbala or are in Karbala.
We read that Shiite militiamen still control all or part of Najaf and Kufa. Is that right?
Yes, they control Najaf and Kufa. They have a presence in Karbala, but I would say do not control it. And they have a presence, but do not control Al-Qut.
And then
they also have a presence further south in Nazaria.
And then the kidnappings. The three Japanese who have been seen around the world now being menaced by their kidnappers and a number of others. Has anyone been released? Where does all that stand today?
Well, as you probably know, a number of Koreans were released overnight, last night. I think there were eight missionaries who were captured, and they were released. But there has been no word that I've heard yet today on the Japanese. But I was down in Karbala until relatively recently, and so I'm not sure that I'm completely current on that.
Alyssa, you've written just today that the uprisings of this last week have imperiled the U.S.-led occupation. Does that occupation feel imperiled tonight?
I think it's probably at its most straitened point since I've been here. There are members of the Governing Council, which is a U.S.-backed body, to some extent picked by the U.S., though not entirely. There was a consensus process to choose it. But there are members threatening to resign. There are a couple who have suspended their membership. They are, in essence, the U.S. Cover. They are the local face for the occupation authority, and they are attempting to mediate between Iraqis and the Americans and British and the rest of the coalition. If those people, who are largely sympathetic to the U.S. and the coalition, feel they can no longer support them, it is hard to see who would feel they could.
And Alyssa, let me ask you, it was 1 year ago today, of course, that the Baghdad fell, marked by the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square. Celebration today in Baghdad of the one-year anniversary of Saddam's toppling?
No, I think a sense of enormous frustration and anger and in some level confusion as well, that somehow all that was promised evaporated like, you know, smoke, and there is not very much to show for it in the eyes of most Iraqis. I mean, there is more than I think often people on the street would give credit for. I mean, there is a much more free press environment. People can certainly speak their mind. There is a judicial system has been set up in which there are, you know, actual judges and trials and witnesses, and people get released on a regular basis, but as well as obviously imprisoned. But there's some level of democracy in choosing members of local councils and all that, but it has not added up to a big difference in people's lives, and it has been tremendously insecure from a safety standpoint, and that means a great deal to people here.
And perhaps most of all, just in this last week, Alyssa Rubin, thanks very much for joining us. Be safe there.
Thank you.
Alyssa Rubin reports on Iraq for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Baghdad. Japanese hostages in Iraq and threats to burn them alive, insurgency and uprising, and tired American troops fighting an elusive enemy in mean city streets. a political future desperately uncertain. This is not the Iraq Americans were led to envision a year ago. This hour on Point, America's Iraq mission in trouble and strategies to salvage a bad, bad situation. What were your expectations a year ago today when Saddam's statue fell? Why have things gone so badly? And if walking away is not an option, how does the United States stay and succeed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Brooklyn, New York, is George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, who returned last week from Baghdad. Good evening and welcome, George Packer.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. And with me in the studio is Graham Allison, director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and former assistant secretary for defense in the Clinton administration. Good evening and welcome, Graham Allison.
Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you both. George Packer, you're just back last week. I'm curious. The events have been so fast and furious this week. I think a lot of people are having a hard time taking on board exactly what's going on. Ted Kennedy and Robert Byrd have started using the Vietnam word. But even at the conservative end of the spectrum, I'm reading Larry Diamond at the conservative Hoover Institute in the Wall Street Journal today. He was an advisor to the coalition. He's saying if this thing isn't taken care of in a politically agile and military forceful way and quickly, he quote, everything we have done to help Iraqis rebuild their country as a democracy could unravel in a matter of weeks. This sounds like a crisis situation. Is that how you see it, George? You've just been there.
Absolutely, it's a crisis. I saw a quotation from a CPA representative in one of the southern towns, and he said 6 months of work has been wiped out responding to the Shiite insurgency in the south. So, yeah, it is by far the biggest crisis since the fall of Baghdad 1 year ago today. I left Iraq just before it all began to break out. That was the end of the time I planned to be there. The night before I left, the CPA closed down the newspaper of the party of Muqtada al-Sadr, called Al-Hawza,
yes,
which precipitated demonstrations in the streets of Baghdad that night. But no one I talked to foresaw what was about to come. The Shiite uprising has been the most surprising thing to me, and I don't know anyone who predicted it. There was a widespread sense of disappointment and anger and disillusionment among Iraqis, including Shia Iraqis. But it's not. It was more intense, but not markedly more so than the last time I was in Iraq, which was late last summer. And so I assume that it was simply an extension of the same feeling, but that it was not a pre-insurrectionary situation. And instead, we've seen large parts of the country slipping out of the control of the occupation forces, and it's been pretty stunning, and it's been hard to keep up with from here.
And the word of the week. Uprising. We're going to dig into that tonight with you, George, and want to learn what you heard on your very recent trip. But Graham Allison, first to you, just top level, how do you perceive, how do you describe what's going on in Iraq now? How big, how deep the trouble that this mission is in?
Well, I think you're right to ask the big questions at this point, and I think we're coming up to the point at which we're going to have to all stand back and do a strategic reassessment of what we have and where it's going. I was talking to somebody about this today, and I said, imagine President Bush is back in Texas, ranch in Texas. He's talking with, as he likes to say, the boys from Lubbock. And one of his friends says to him, you know, look, I support you completely, and I have full confidence in you, but I've been just asking myself, do these folks you hired to run the war know what they're doing or not?
What's the evidence tonight, Graham?
And I would say the evidence is that, unfortunately, they don't. I think if you ask in terms of a ground truth, you listen to what they say or have been saying and watch what's happening. If you ask about the question of a realistic plan to get from here to somewhere, if you look at military strategy and tactics and whether this is going to lead to an outcome that we can live with, and as one tries to think about a political handoff, which is scheduled for some artificial date on
June 30th right now,
that looks quite unrealistic and implausible. So I suspect that over the next several weeks, as if things go as badly as they appear to be doing, ultimately even the U.S. government will be standing back and saying, whoa, we need to engage in a strategic reassessment of where we now are and what our realistic options are.
George Packer, we've just got 30 seconds before we have to take a break, but what's your sense? We'll get to the Iraqis, but the Americans that you talked with in Baghdad, do they have the flexibility to step back and do a big reassessment of the sort Graham Allison's describing?
Well, part of the problem is the public presentation is at such odds with the reality that some of the press briefings are just hard to take seriously. I mean, just today, General Mark Kemet said that there were low-level actions in various parts of Iraq. And this, while Fallujah seems to be just a complete battleground. So in private, there are doubts admitted. But in public, there's a united front, which extends to Washington, and it does not induce confidence.
George Packer, Graham Allison, stand by. We're talking tonight about America's Iraq mission in crisis. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's Iraq mission in crisis and strategies to salvage a bad, bad situation. I'm joined tonight from Brooklyn, New York, by George Packer, New Yorker staff writer who's just returned from a month in Iraq. He left just last week, and with me in the studio tonight, Graham Allison, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy and Plans and Director of the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can join this conversation as well. What were your expectations when Saddam's statue toppled for all the world's TV cameras a year ago today? What are your hopes, your fears now? And what do you see in the photographs of Americans dead and Iraqis enraged a year on? Did you expect the headlines to read, Fighting Rages, Sunnis and Shiites Ally Against U.S. American Occupation Imperiled? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. George Packer, you've been there talking with American officials and with a lot of Iraqis. How has it come to this? What's happened here?
Well, you know, one Iraqi, and actually echoing many other Iraqis, said to me, you know, this was not the America we imagined. We knew America from movies and the media, and we had this great respect for it, and now we see it up close, and we see that it breaks its promises, it doesn't deliver what it says it will, and it's cruel and arbitrary. Now, of course, the fantasy America is impossible and unrealistic, and expectations were impossibly high. And the America they see is an occupying force, which is inherently an irritating and frustrating, if not enraging, situation for both sides to find themselves in. But, you know, if we go back to last April 9th, already the seeds of what we're seeing today were being sown on that very day. The statue fell. It was a moment of great triumph. But at the same time, Iraqis were beginning to loot their own capital, and the destruction wrought by the looting was greater than anything that the war had achieved in the city. And Iraqis told me that, you know, if there was one thing that the coalition did wrong that they would have them go back and redo, it was their failure to assert law and order from the very start. And I have the feeling that they have never caught up essentially with the damage that they allowed to happen in the very first days after the liberation, that it already was slipping away from them, even when everyone was celebrating the triumph.
But, George, you're talking about American broken promises and cruelty. On the other hand, the United States went in, they took out a tyrant who had killed so many Iraqis. Billions have been poured into Iraq. A lot was destroyed, but a lot, we're told, has been built. Why this perception of cruelty and broken promises as opposed to the glass half full?
Right. Well, I think this has been something that reporters and other observers have sort of had a hard time getting their minds around. But, you know, the liberation, the euphoria from it lasted a very short time for Iraqis. And although to this day some Iraqis told me that they remain grateful to the Americans for getting rid of Saddam, it just didn't have the kind of staying power as the dominant emotion that you might have expected. And instead, the mistakes and failures of especially the early months of the occupation, sort of left an imprint that has never gone away. And on the Iraqi side, there's also this tremendous problem of their lack of solid information, the lack of a really serious media outlet from the coalition, And essentially years and years of listening to rumors and hearing conspiracy theories and quite justifiable levels of paranoia, which didn't shut off overnight. And they've continued into this new era. And in fact, the new era is far more confusing to Iraqis than the Saddam era, which they've gotten quite used to. So it's not surprising when you think about it that Iraqis really don't know how to judge exactly what the objective reality of their situation is. If you tell them, well, electricity levels are beyond pre-war levels, and in fact, unemployment has gone down recently and salaries are higher. It simply doesn't sink in because expectations were so much higher and because the frustrations of the occupation and being under the control of foreigners has sort of overwhelmed everything that all the small achievements, the small but real achievements that are there. And above all, the insecurity, the sense of fear, the sense that violence could come from any direction just dominates people's daily lives, and it's very difficult for any good news to sink in.
Seems to me it's tough even for Americans, maybe especially for Americans as well, to judge the objective reality of what's going on there. Sometimes I even wonder about American officials. Graham Allison, you sat in the Defense Department. You see the level of this engagement and perhaps the level of this crisis. How do you get a rethink at this point in such a massive engagement where so much has been laid down in rhetoric and in framing and so much invested in a particular view of what's going on? How does a government say, hey, we've got to all sit down and think through again what's going on here?
Well, a great question. And I think, unfortunately, mostly governments don't do this and don't do it very well until after facts grind people down little by little as they see things that are contrary to script. I think George's point that there's a script here that's been developed that is repeated on every occasion. Everything's going according
from
to plan.
From the Pentagon podium, from there, the podium
from
in
the
Baghdad,
podium
from the White
in Baghdad,
House.
That any such incidents are isolated and it's not the whole country or it's not everybody, or as if anybody imagined that it was the whole country or everybody, mm-hmm, just a lot, mm-hmm. And that of course, this is a test of will, but we're just about to get over this. So I think once one's sort of engaged in an enterprise so vast with such consequences, committing American lives and money and reputation, I mean, we own Iraq. This is our problem now. And at that point to say, whoa, but the plan that we have doesn't quite seem to fit the facts as we're observing them, will take time. There's no doubt about that. But I believe that what's likely to happen is that one will see now a serious military push to try to suppress the resistance.
It seems to already be begun. Certainly in Fallujah, heavy force brought.
And there's no question that we have enough force to destroy whatever. Okay.
Destroy whatever, except perhaps an uprising, especially if it becomes truly a popular uprising.
Well, even if the
25 million Iraqis,
if one were willing to, the American military can do any mission that it's assigned. But as we remember from Vietnam, if you destroy the village in order to save it, the killing of people actually ends up having a huge effect on the view of the people who are not killed about what you're doing there and how friendly you are. So as one watches the bombing of a mosque or the area around a mosque or the retaking of Fallujah or the attempt to disband or destroy the militias of this fellow Sadr, you're engaged in a very large-scale operation against Shiite. Now, many other Shiite look at that and say, this looks a whole lot like, the pictures they see on their TVs of Israelis and Palestinians.
Let me ask you this, then. You're the big think guy sitting at Harvard looking out on all of this. Despite all the military power, in the end, you can't win this just by killing people. The whole point is to make Iraqis produce a better life there. At least that's what we're told. Is it possible that the U.S., in the midst of chaos, turmoil, civil war, Sunni-Shia alliance, urban warfare, popular uprising, could the U.S. fail here? Or is that simply out of the question?
Well, it's a hard question to ask and a hard question even to contemplate, because the stakes are so large, and they're stakes not just for the Bush administration and for the enthusiasts for the war, but for a country, because once one's there, this is us. This is our society, and the consequences for Turkey, for Saudi Arabia, for the region, for the Middle East, for American reputation in the world are vast. But I think that what is likely to happen, I fear, if things continue along the current course, is that we'll have to look at the question and say, okay, what are our realistic options at this point, of which one certainly has to be declaring victory and retreating, in effect.
Is that really an option, given the kind of chaos we're seeing there, which could easily portend civil war? We've been told that is unacceptable.
Well, if one were seeing a situation out of control, there are going to be two, or there will be several options. One is we could double up or triple up the number of American forces there, fight and win the war, stay for several years, create stability, and grow something. That actually was the view of General Shinseki, who was the chief of staff of the Army at the time this was undertaken.
But those numbers of U.S. troops aren't really available, are they?
Well, if your task was to do it, it may take time, but it could be done. But this would be a vast undertaking, and who's going to do this, particularly in the context of
presidential
election.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we think back ourselves in our own history in Vietnam, we kind of went up and we went down and we went back and we went forth. But at a point, Lyndon Johnson, who had pursued the war vigorously, called in the people whose opinions he trusted, and they said to him, we believe that we're losing, and we believe that we now have to conclude this, and we believe that we have to get out with the least amount of damage. That's in that case. If you look at the case of the Israelis in Lebanon, they stayed there for a long time. It was a mistake to go. It was a mistake to stay. Eventually, Barak said, it's time for us to leave, and they left. So I think that I'm not proposing that that's the only option now or the best option. But I think that when people stand back and say, what are the realistic options today, they're all very unpalatable.
And there must be a third of trying to get the rest of the world engaged so it's not just on America's shoulders.
And that would be the one that should be the most preferred. But under the circumstances where things seem to be dangerous and chaotic, persuading the people who are there, the few, the very few, who are doing anything other than trying to protect themselves to stay is difficult enough. But going back and trying to reassemble the kind of coalition that should have been assembled in the first place if we were trying to undertake this under a UN flag and giving over to that authority a lot of the leeway in terms of what's actually done, I think would be the best of the options. But if you ask me how realistic is that one, I would say it's very difficult to imagine how you get it done.
The rest of the world may say no thanks.
Yeah, just as a fact, if you try to ask, if the number of military and security forces securing Iraq were proportionate to the number who are in Bosnia, Herzegovina,
yeah,
there would be 500,000 people there.
Instead of 150 or whatever it is.
Instead of 150. And we've been in there for how long now? I think it's 11 years.
Yeah. That's a very different ratio. Graham Allison, George Packer, stand by. I want to begin to invite our callers in. Majed is calling from Boston. Hi, Majed. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for giving me this chance. Mm-hmm. I would like to say that as someone from the Middle East, especially from Saudi Arabia, and I live in Boston for a long time.
Okay.
I wanted to say that basically there is one factor that's being, I think, ignored here, is the issue of self-esteem in the Middle East. I think we need
self-esteem.
To have self-esteem and self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, because of a long history of colonization and wars and loss, of wars and so on, there is big damage for the self-esteem of people in the Middle East. And if we want to do nation building and democracy, we need to build individuals that have self-respect. And I think that personally, the first step is to have more of the Arab governments involved in the process in Iraq, because this will give the Arab people at least a feeling that this is not something being done to them, but they are also participating in the process, and they need to feel at least some sense of respect and, that their opinion matter. In
so try process. And make it not just outsiders, but a kind of pan-Arab effort. Majed, thanks for your call. George Packer, does that appear to be an option, a real option for the U.S. here?
Well, I'm not sure Iraqis would welcome that quite so readily as the caller imagines. Iraqis feel betrayed by the Arab world. The Arab world left them to the devices of Saddam Hussein, who most Arab countries supported. The Arab League barely tolerated the first prime minister that Iraq sent to them, who happened to be a Kurd. Iraq is not an entirely Arab country, and Iraqis are justifiably suspicious of the intentions of their Arab neighbors because they haven't been good historically. They also refuse to allow Turkish troops into Iraq.
Yeah.
So, and Iran also comes under a good deal of suspicion for meddling in Iraqi affairs. So I don't think simply considering this a pan-Arab problem is the answer, especially since the Arab countries have seemed more threatened than anything else by the fact that Iraq now has, for all its problems, a more representative governing council than any government in the Arab world.
So, George, you're there sitting at the Pentagon or in the White House. You're the American citizen tapped for a suggestion on where to go here in a tight spot. What's your suggestion? What's the room to move?
I think, first of all, June 30th, which is the has been the ironclad date and quite artificial for the handoff of sovereignty, has to at least be reconsidered. It shouldn't simply be scrapped, but the governing council, which is the only body of Iraqis who have any kind of say at the moment that isn't simply the word of the street, have to be brought into a discussion with the CPA. I think part of why we're seeing this uprising right now is there's been a political vacuum in Iraq. The CPA and Bremer, perhaps because they felt they needed to show that there was a boss, have not empowered the Iraqis beyond the rather weak decision-making powers that the governing council has to take political charge.
But isn't
so,
pushing
so
toward
been,
a June 3rd?
There's been a vacuum, into this vacuum, Muqtada al-Sadr has rushed.
But, George, let me ask you, isn't pushing toward that June 30th date part of an effort to get this into the hands of the Iraqis and make it more their own show?
Yes and no. I mean, sure, you could. On the one hand, Iraqis themselves are quite impatient, as we see every day in the news, for this occupation to end. On the other hand, what does it mean to declare that Iraq is sovereign if there remain 150,000 coalition troops under the command of coalition commanders? If the vast majority of the budget is still coming from American taxpayers' money, and if there is no government in Iraq to receive sovereignty, this is a huge problem. We don't know who and what structure will take over on July 1st. And so June 30th has become this mythic date that has absolutely no content. And I think that the fighting right now has probably put a halt to whatever slow progress was being made toward establishing an interim government.
It is pretty amazing that nobody knows who it's going to be. Mike is calling from Black Arrow, Wisconsin. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. It's
yeah.
a good show.
Thanks, Mike.
Two fast points. My father wrote a book about Stratford Canning, British ambassador during the Crimean War.
Okay.
And during a lot of the research he did for that book, we talked a lot about the mentality that exists in the Arab world. And it seems to me we're just too nice, in a way, to the people who want to mess this up. And for example, if people are flooding in from Syria and flooding in from Iran, I think we need to really make a statement and not let that happen.
Though I don't know if it's clear that that's really happening. But you're saying more iron fist, more toughness. Is that it, Mike?
Well, let's take this guy Sadr. If we can even determine what mosque he's in, I think we should just bomb the mosque and get it over with. Because I think they respect that kind of overwhelming force. And I think that we need to establish the idea that if you step out of line, it's over for you.
Mike, our time is short before the break.
We give the people who are there who want peace a chance to step up and finally.
We've got it. Let me pick that up quickly. And thanks for your call, Mike. George Packer, I'm going to give that to you. What if the Pentagon said we're really going to step, pedal to the metal here on military power? Is that a path to success or to more backlash?
It's a very bad idea. I mean, of course, in the short term, you will extinguish the problem. In the long term, you'll have a much greater problem. That's the logic of every guerrilla war. We've fallen into it here in Iraq, just as we did in Vietnam. And I think overwhelming force simply is not the answer. Politics is the answer. Creating a political structure that can represent Iraqis as a legitimate body is the answer. We haven't done that until now.
But in this week, when things are in such turmoil, a tough time to be talking politics, even if it's the way we have to go. Graham Allison, George Packer, please stand by. We're talking tonight about America's Iraq mission in crisis. You can join the conversation. If walking away is not an option, how does the U.S. stay and succeed? And what message do you read in the weary eyes of American Marines under fire, sleepless, struggling? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's Iraq mission in crisis and strategies to salvage a bad situation. You can join the conversation tonight if walking away is not an option. How does the U.S. stay and succeed? What's your confidence at this point in the leadership in Iraq of Paul Bremer, of Donald Rumsfeld, of George Bush? And if the U.S. went into Iraq with illusions, with unreal plans, how can the country get real now about Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by New Yorker writer George Packer, back just last week from Iraq. And with me in the studio tonight, Graham Allison, former Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director of the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Let's take a call. Brian is calling from Boston. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I'll make 2 points really quickly. The first is, I think we have a two-front battle here, two main fronts. The first one is politically here in the United States. The second one is obviously in Iraq. The first front here, quite frankly, I think we need to put muzzles on people like Ted Kennedy who are calling this Vietnam. It's simply not true, and we can look at the figures to get at that. I don't have any doubt that we've got big tragedies and loss. Everyone feels badly about every loss we see in the papers every day. My comment to George, there are two times as many homicides in New York City every year than we lost in the same period in Iraq. So we need to look at this realistically, take the rhetoric out of it,
yep,
and win it.
But Brian, looking at it this week, realistically, does it ever cross your mind? Do you fear that we could get an uprising going on here that no army can really control? If you get a real popular uprising going, you know what that's like for soldiers.
Our soldiers are trained to fight. I was actually happy to see these people uprising because given the targets, the Marines will take them out. It breaks my heart to see them not have the opportunity to take out targets when they're hit by these bombs in the streets. I want these people to rise up because we will put them down. And then the people who want peace, like our friend from Wisconsin just mentioned, a previous caller,
mm-hmm,
the people who do want peace over there will have their day.
Brian, we've got it. George Packer, your response, please. Here again, this impulse to go in tough, show who's boss, and the peacemakers will come around.
You know, it's really easy to talk that way from over here, but when you're over there and you know what it means to go in tough and you know what kind of damage is done, not just to insurgents, but to people around them, to families, to neighborhoods, to people's thinking. I mean, forget about whether we think this is Vietnam. What matters is what Iraqis think. And if Iraqis think that this occupation has become an insidious force that's there to take their country from them, I'm not saying all Iraqis think that way, but more and more do, that's an enormous problem for us. Who are we going to be occupying and turning sovereignty over to if our own legitimacy is being eroded every day in the minds of Iraqis, partly by the kind of mindless get-tough military posture that we're taking right now in Fallujah, which seems to be breaking apart our own created governing council. If we can't hold on to the governing council, what have we got as a political body that can express the wishes of Iraqis? So, it's just all too easy to say we have to win this by force. The whole point of this is you cannot win it by force. You have to win it by being smart and also by politics, as I said earlier.
It is true. You've had governing council members today. Hey, governing council members, these are supposed to be very close to the U.S. saying what's going on in Fallujah is an outrage. We need international intervention to stop what the U.S. is doing. And these are supposed to be America's friends. Graham Allison, you can feel this kind of binary tension in the American political conversation. Do we hang tough or do we become critical and sort of go into the Vietnam metaphor that we've heard from Byrd, we've heard from Senator Kennedy now? Let me ask you about that latter thing. The word, the idea, the history, the memory of Vietnam, is it helpful here? Is it useful or not?
Well, analogies are both useful but also misleading. And I agree with the caller that to just put a Vietnam label on it and think, okay, now I got the storyline and I got the picture and I know how it came out is misleading. On the other hand, Vietnam is one piece of history, like Lebanon is another piece of history, and the various guerrilla wars that we've seen around, you know, the last 50 or 100 years help us see what a difficult situation we're in. I think there's no question whatever that there are a number of troops that if the U.S. put there, either American troops or an American and alliance troops, but they might be two or three times the level of troops we have now.
So get up toward a Vietnam level, nearing half a million.
And who are prepared to stay there for a significant period of time, one could bring this story to a successful conclusion. The chief of staff of the U.S. Army and the majority of people in the U.S. Army believe that this was what was going to be required in for the post-conflict. So this is not a crazy new view now. This was General Shinseki. Paul Wolfowitz told him he was blowing smoke because we were going to be liberating people.
It was going to be lean and mean and flowers for everybody.
And a few troops was going to be enough to get this to happen. Maybe that's still going to happen. We could wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden Iraq could become stable. But I think the evidence is mounting that that's not likely to be the case.
George Packer, we have just 1 minute left here. How about it? Flood the zone, half a million U.S. soldiers, and we could bring this around or not?
I'd rather see half a million soldiers from all sorts of countries. I've known we've needed more troops ever since I was there last summer. It was clear that they were all undermanned and stretched too thin. But another way in which Vietnam is not appropriate, Vietnam was lost politically before we ever got in there. And so we were throwing good after bad from the beginning. Whereas in Iraq, actually, politically, we won on the first day. We've been losing ever since. That's why I don't completely despair here. I still think there are a lot of Iraqis who are still, in spite of everything, counting on the Americans and the rest of the world to help them get to something better than what they've known and who have not given up on this because the alternatives are actually worse, as most Iraqis know. The problem is the occupation hasn't known how to reach them, hasn't known how to give them a vehicle to have their voices heard. And until we start doing that, simply trying to win this by military means is folly. And it's, in fact, what the insurgents want us to do because that's the logic that that loses for us and wins for them.
Well, clearly some time for some very, very focused thinking. I thank each of you, Graham Allison and George Packer, for what you've brought us on that front tonight. Graham Allison, thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleasure.
And George Packer in New York, thank you very much for reporting and for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me with a look back at an eventful week. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Unbelievable news coming in weeks, said one. Big event. There will be a very, 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 very big uproar. There will be attacks in the near future. Troubling, yes. But they don't tell us when, they don't tell us where, they don't tell us who, and they don't tell us how.
When Dr. Rice says we couldn't have predicted that four planes would be used as bombs by suicide hijackers, that's a straw man. We were surprised that one plane was hijacked. Everything that happened on the 11th of September indicated that we were unprepared for something, in my view, that we should at very least suspect it.
We will conduct offensive operations. We will attack to destroy the Mahdi army.
See a large cloud of smoke coming from the area inside Fallujah. There is return fire from the buildings.
They make recommendations, and I sign deployment orders. You can be certain that if they want more troops, we will sign deployment orders.
After a year, continued strife in Iraq, comes word that the commander of forces in the region is seeking options to increase the number of U.S. troops on the ground, if necessary. Surely, I am not the only one who hears echoes of Vietnam in this development.
The occupation will end on June 30th, but the coalition forces will remain as partners with the Iraqis. We will work alongside the Iraqi police, the army, the civil defense force, after June 30th, together to be partners in bringing security here.
This is one of the most extraordinary situations I've ever seen. You don't set an arbitrary date for the transfer of power to a non-entity.
And there is a week. Condoleezza Rice testifies in front of the 9/11 Commission that there was no silver bullet that could have prevented the September 11th attacks. Commission member Bob Kerry expresses dissatisfaction with Rice's testimony. A bloody week in Iraq. 42 U.S. troops and as many as 460 Iraqis die in fierce fighting spread across several cities. Donald Rumsfeld indicates more troops may be heading to Iraq and that those already there may be serving longer than planned. Senators Robert Byrd and Edward Kennedy use the word Vietnam to describe the situation in Iraq. And despite the turmoil, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer says the June 30th handover of power to Iraqis will go forward, to the chagrin of Democratic presidential nominee-in-waiting John Kerry. Jack Beatty, a very, very rough week. My gosh, the scenes from Iraq and the tension around testimony on Capitol Hill, quite extraordinary.
Quite extraordinary, and you'd think that the public would be paying attention these past 2 weeks, but a couple of polls say not so. Only 50% of Americans, according to an overnight poll, either knew that Rice was testifying or knew anything that she said. Last week, 56% of Americans said they had not seen photos nor TV images of the lynched contractors in Fallujah. So
such striking images, but yet not penetrating. In a way, there's a message out there saying, don't take this on too deeply. Everything will be all right.
You know, I really think so. I mean, people just don't seem to want to touch it for fear that it's going to disturb them. And how could it not disturb them? My God, what a horrifying series of developments. But in the middle of it, Condoleezza Rice, with her poised and articulate and forceful statements before the committee. However, just going over the web, you can, for example, at places like the Center for American Progress, I've got 25 different contradictions and or misstatements or factually inaccurate or contradicted statements. Let me just give you a few of them.
Yeah.
That are documented. She says, we decided immediately to continue pursuing the Clinton administration's covert action program and other efforts to fight the network. Well, Newsweek reported that in the months before 9/11, the Justice Department curtailed a highly classified program called Catcher's Mitt to monitor al-Qaeda suspects in the U.S., and it suspended the Predator drones, even though they had spotted Bin Laden three times in 2000. Claim, she said, the strategy set as its goal, that's the administration strategy, the elimination of al-Qaeda networks. It ordered the leadership of relevant U.S. departments and agencies to work toward that elimination, to make it a high priority. And here's from here's last week, Jamie Gorelick questioning Deputy Secretary of State Armitage. Is it true, as Dr. Rice said, that the plans call for military options to attack al-Qaeda? Armitage, no. I think that was amended after the horror of 9/11. Ms. Rice claimed, one final one, we bolstered the Treasury Department's activities to track and seize terrorist assets. In fact, the new Bush Treasury, quote, disapproved of the Clinton administration's approach to money laundering issues, which had been an important part of the effort to cut the money flow to Bin Laden, and that they basically stopped that program. This is from, the source of that is a book called The Age of Sacred Terror. On and on and on it goes.
Well, one way or another, the commission is helping lay out a record of statement and perhaps contradiction here. Jack, let me ask you something, though. After all the testimony from Condoleezza Rice this week, let's just imagine a world in which the Bush administration had not come in, the Clinton gang had stayed right there, right through that September. Do you think it would have been different? Do you think 9/11 would have been derailed?
Oh, what did Richard Clark say? He essentially said no, because someone said to him, what would have happened if the plan you gave the Bush administration in January, essentially the Clinton plan,
yeah,
if all of that had been implemented, would that have prevented 9/11? He said he didn't think it would.
It may be frustrating to see people try and wiggle away from responsibility and not step straight up, you know, declassifying things and being very straightforward, but it is important at some level to remember that what came before might have led, very well would have led, to the very same outcome, though one wishes it could be different. Somebody would have stepped up and done something more.
Right, but Clark also says that if the administration had reacted to the crisis in August and done something then something might have been able to stop.
Could have been. There was that spike, that threat spike over the summer. and maybe a disinclination to really look at it. An extraordinary week of testimony and events, what they pretend, well, we don't know tonight, but it's not a pretty picture right now. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us, and have a good weekend.
Thank you, and you too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.